Hey, just real quick, wanted to apologize to Kent and to all of you guys. As you know, as you watch this, we had a little bit of an audio issue at the very beginning. Got that taken care of. If you want to skip all that part where it was just me, which I did keep in there because we did talk about the book a little bit, about the 8 minute mark, if you want to hit that, that'll get you up to where you can actually hear Kent conversing back and forth after we got the audio squared away. Shout out to Twin Scythe TV, longtime viewer who pointed that out to us. Appreciate that. Got everything taken care of. All right. So today, and let me get that off of there. Nobody needs to see that little participation thing on the side. We are here with William, call me Kent Krueger, the man, the myth, the Minnesota legend. I go over a list of awards, but I realized it was easier just to say that if you made a list of book awards with pretty much anything except for maybe the Hugo and throw a dart at it, you will hit something he's won. I know the last, it was 9, is it 10 now, have all been New York Times bestsellers, I think. 10 straight New York best time sellers. So, you know, he's got a little bit of talent. He's not one of those guys where, you know, it's like, yeah, he had a couple of good books, but, you know, Thunder Bay, eh. Yeah, pretty much anything he writes is golden. I did want to mention, we do have a couple little parallels, very small parallels. I know, Kent, that you married a girl from Nebraska and moved to Minnesota, as to where I moved to Nebraska and married a girl from Minnesota. You're a best-selling author, and I really like to read. Guess what, we got that going for us. And you've got snow, and I've just got sleet at the moment, so that's going on. Couple of things I found quite interesting in your background. One, we know you got kicked out of Stanford. I have told that the history has been blocked, and that if I bring it up too much, I will find myself in a black site, so we're not going to go into that. But, I mean, logging as a background, obviously your journalism, we know you love to write. One thing I found interesting, and I want to bring it back because I'm going to bring it back both to Cork's series and This Tender Land. I know you ended up studying child development, which was, you know, not necessarily your first choice. I think you wanted to go into anthropology at one point. Is that right? Which I don't blame you. I just wondered if maybe that background helped you out because, for instance, with the Cork O'Connor series, that's been going on a while. We started out, you know, you've got everything from the kids being very young to where they're full grown adults now. I mean, your stories, it's not like one of those ones where every book the guy ages like a month. I mean, Cork O'Connor's aged with you. So you're doing a little bit better than the Baby Blues comic strip. So, you know, they 10 years, they had a compilation of like 10 years and still in diapers. But I think I appreciate that. I think especially for your long-term fans, I mean, we feel like we're growing with Cork. Cork, yeah. Well, and speaking of your experience, I mean, I know you got something there because I wanted to actually congratulate you. I believe March, if I remember correctly, 50 years you guys have been married. Yeah, well, you better say that. Exactly. Well, I mean, you don't last 50 years if you don't have that feeling. 50 years, that's commitment. So, like I said, hats off to you. It probably shouldn't be a major thing, but it is a major thing these days. And, you know, that just speaks to your relationship. Although I did find it a little funny, not about your relationship, but I did find it a little funny. I know I saw you were talking to Craig Johnson not too long ago. And I still think he's in a little bit of a disbelief, the amount of hours you spend a day writing. The fact that you're so good and you're so prolific and you're only putting in like 3 hours a day. True. Gotcha. And part of the reason I wanted to bring that up, too, is I think a lot of times, especially newer writers, they feel like there's this whole myth, especially if you're on Twitter. It's like, oh, you got to write 10,000 words a day, or, oh, you got to put in 8 hours a day. It's like, no, you got to put in what you can put in. So, you know, some authors, they don't feel like they've got a day until they've hit that magic mark. But for other authors, and like I said, I came in late to your series. I actually read This Tender Land was the first book that I'd read of yours. My wife had obviously read Ordinary Grace, and I think she's got pretty much the entire Cork O'Connor series. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. In fact, this one is hers. She told me I have to send it back here when I'm done. You actually signed that for us when you were in Omaha, which I totally appreciate. But I came in a little bit late, and I just say I loved especially the latest one. I know you said that this one is the first one you've written in present tense, but it worked for the story so well. And I loved the fact that you, because I love first person narrative, and the fact that a lot of times first person narrative, though, you don't get those other sites, and you do the first person narrative, but it's broken up. So you like, it's this person's first person's perspective. And then we're going to the next part of the story is going to be in another person's first person's perspective. Gotcha. And I also love, like, it's very much step by step, but there is a couple spots, and I don't want to go into details because the book's out new. I don't want to do any spoilers, but there's a couple spots, especially, I'll just say, on the island, where it's your perspective up to this, and then all of a sudden there's that little jump back, so that other person, you get that little bit leading up to what just happened, which I love that, just a little bit of overlap. It really, I felt like it kept the story moving. I read that book very quickly. It was just a nice, smooth, easy read. It was very, well, I'll tell you, I have started back over with, I almost said Ordinary Grace, that's not the right one, Iron Lake. And basically, I'm probably going to reread these. So I will get back to Fox Creek again. It's going to be making its rounds again. One thing I wanted to bring up before we get too much into this, I'm going to get into Cork in a second. I just wanted to touch briefly on this Tender Land, because I actually saw the interview that you did with Poison Pen. I'm always willing to give them a shout out. I love those guys. And the fact that, I'll tell you, you mentioned Mark Twain when you were talking about it. I definitely, when I read this Tenderland, got a very Tom Sawyer-ish feel. But I love the fact that, too, you brought up the fact that someone brought up L. Frank Baum. And you're like, you know, I can kind of see that. And I love that basically all of us, our own experience, had a slight, maybe a slightly different viewpoint on that book. And yet it was still a bestseller. Everybody loved it. Yeah, it's... I know there's like right now there's a whole Twitter thing going on. I'm not going to pick one side or the other. Some people think that you absolutely can't write a story unless you read all the time. But I also get that other side, too, is like, yes, if you read all the time, some of that's going to work it into your story. But I don't feel like it's necessarily necessary. Let me see what's going on here. Sorry, Kent, can you say something real quick? That is good. Why is that not coming through? Apparently they can hear me. I can hear you. They can't hear you. So let me figure out if I can find out what's going on. Thank you, Twin, by the way, for letting me know that. I have not changed anything. This should be playing you with absolutely no problem.
Were they able to hear me at...
My guess is no, but Twin just got on here. Is that making a difference? Yeah, that didn't make a difference either. Twin said we had it for a moment, but I don't know what I did. So let me... This is... Sorry, just checking the properties on this real quick. There we go.
Lord of Darkness among the gusty.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate that. Hopefully the Zoom will also have recorded this, and I can. Yep, thank you. Twin says everything's good to go. All right. So hopefully I can get that covered on there. Basically, we just went over Twin. We went over the backstory on Tenderland real quick and mainly do an intro. So now we're going to kind of get into the Cork O'Connor series. So we are at least hopefully getting the big part of this. I have to start back with Iron Lake. I do have a question for you. You've probably been asked this before. You probably have already answered it. Joe, knowing how their relationship started in Iron Lake, and knowing where it ended, and then just in case nobody's read it, I'm not going to spoil how it ended.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
But did you always see, was that some sort of idea that you were going to have in your head that Cork was going to go through this, and this was how that whole relationship was going to go? Or was when it ended, is that when you just got to the point, it's like, okay, this is where it naturally needs to end? Was that like in that book thing, or was that from book one?
No, most of the time I fly by the seat of my pants. When I wrote Iron Lake, honest to God, I didn't know I was writing the first book in the series. I just wanted to write something that was good enough somebody might actually want to buy it and publish it. But toward the end of Iron Lake, I realized I had created relationships that were very complex, and I wasn't going to be able to tie up everything at the end of Iron Lake neatly. And I thought, okay, where do I want all of these people to be in their lives eventually? And as I thought about it, I thought, you know, it's going to take me maybe three books to get there. And in fact, it did. If you look at the first three books in this series, Iron Lake, Boundary Waters, and Purgatory Ridge, it's the arc of the relationship that of Cork's marriage, from its almost disillusion to the place where they're able to come back together again in a committed relationship. And then I knew, okay, I got a series going here. I didn't always know book to book where the next book was going to take me. And in fact, in the book we will not mention, where the relationship finally comes to an end, I can't exactly tell you why I chose to do it in that particular book. It just seemed kind of right. And what it did was allow me to spend some time with Cork in a very introspective and grieving state, and then follow him in his journey as he heals and as the whole family heals.
Yeah, and I actually saw, and I can't remember.
It was an interesting, it was just a fascinating experience as a storyteller, Ed.
Well, I don't think, no, if you've noticed it, but I read somewhere, and I can't remember who said it, so I apologize that I can't give them credit, but somebody was talking about your books, and that is very much, for instance, that book was all about grief, and that, like, each one of your books, even though it's this obviously, you know, you've got a murder mystery story going on, each one almost had, like, a different theme to it, and that's, like, that was the theme of that book, and they love that about it.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I don't want to do is, you know, I don't know if you've had this experience. You discover a series that you really enjoy, and you read maybe the first six, seven, eight books in the series, and they're really terrific. And then something happens. The life seems to go out of the series. And I think what you're reading there are contractual obligations. An author signed on for, you know, three or four novels and is just tired of it. I never want to put out a book that I haven't invested my heart in fully. And so as I make decisions about the plot lines, the storylines, I always want to be doing something that's dynamic and interesting to me, and that allows me to be on a journey of my own as the storyteller. If I promised myself a long time ago, if I got to the point where I was just going to phone in a Cork O'Connor novel, I'm out of here. I don't want to do that. I want to be able to invest my creative energies and my emotional heart in the story.
I think it comes through, like I said, especially in Fox Creek. I love the where this goes. I also loved one other thing that you said, though, about Fox Creek. And not to steal your thunder, but you've said this in a couple of interviews, so I know it's out there. You sat down and wrote that opening scene, having no clue where it's going. It is such a perfect setup for where it went that it's almost hard to believe that you didn't write this to get there, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. No, honest to God, I wrote the opening scene and I'm going, well, that's pretty good, but where the hell do we go from here?
It's great, though.
You know, I had a general idea of what I needed to accomplish in that novel. In the Cork O'Connor book before that, Desolation Mountain, well, the one before that is actually Lightning Strike,
yep.
The prequel. The book before that in the series is again a contemporary setting. And at the end of that story, I give the reader sort of this doom thing. Both Henry Malou and Stephen O'Connor have had a vision of Henry's death. And so I knew that in Fox Creek, I need to deal with this. But I really didn't have any idea how I was going to do that. How I was going to resolve that situation. So I wrote the opening scene just to sort of play around with something and get pulled into thinking of the story through.
So when you said you knew you had to deal with that, is that because you knew you had to deal with that, or you knew that if I don't deal with this, my fans are going to be like, hey, what about?
Yeah, well, you know, you can't have a guy fall off a cliff and leave them hanging there in the next book. You gotta, did he hit the bottom or did he not? You know? So yeah, I knew after when I, you know, I took a break and wrote the prequel, Lightning Strike, in part because I wasn't sure how to deal with the situation I had set up in Desolation Mountain. I wasn't sure whether it was going to be Henry's time or not.
Well, and we will not tell anybody if it's Henry's time or not, because they need to read the book. I had a couple questions else. There were not just about this one. I know you can't necessarily answer this definitively, but I know when you were talking to Craig Johnson's, for instance, and you talked about some of the how much the fun the adjunct characters, as you called them, are. You have an adjunct character in Henry Malou that we absolutely love. I would say that Johnson has an adjunct character in Henry Standing Bear that pretty much everybody loves. And if they didn't love him in the book, Lou Diamond Phillips did an absolutely excellent job in that role.
Couldn't agree more. The guy who plays Longmire, can't remember his name, man. I thought he was a great Longmire.
I want to say Robert Taylor, but don't quote me on that.
I think you're right. Yeah, I think you're right.
Because I think I was at a Craig Johnson event when he was talking about the fact that they'd sent him a bunch of actors, and when he got to Robert Taylor's picture, his wife's like, "That's them." He's like, "Okay." But, and of course, obviously, I don't know if you guys have the same publisher, if it would ever be possible, or where the situation is. Would there ever be a spot where maybe you and Craig, maybe prequel or, you know, something in the future, write something where those two characters, I would love to see those two characters on the same page. That's all I'm saying. It's going to put that out there.
Ain't going to happen, Ed.
Okay, I tried. So maybe somebody could make a trip from Wyoming to Minnesota.
Craig and I are really good friends. We admire, we respect each other's work. But a collaboration of that sort, I don't think so.
Not a problem. I still would love to see it, though. It seems like those two characters, yeah.
You know, maybe in the realm of fan fiction.
Yeah, somebody will try. They can you know, crack a couple of beers, hang out. All right. One other question I have, and I'm wondering if you even have this in mind or if it's a possibility. I feel like, to a great extent, you know, we've seen Cork's kids grow up. We've gone through it. We've grown up with them. Do you ever see a book in the future where Cork hands the reins over to one of them and, you know, kind of hold the PI detective, you know, whatever thing? Or personally, right now, of course, things could change. Do you see a point where they're going to move on and Cork's, you know, going to kind of still be doing his thing alone?
Yes to all of those things.
Gotcha. Everything's on the table. Got it.
No, I honestly can't imagine writing a story in which Cork doesn't play a significant role. I mean, in the series, he's only 55. But I'm not sure what's going on there, but I love it.
Sorry, I got a new phone and I thought I had turned off the sound, and the sound says it's all the way down, but apparently text messages are just still coming through. Sorry about that.
Is that your ringtone?
That's my ringtone. You got a text
I love
message.
My ringtone.
I love it too, but it's not supposed to be on while I'm talking. Apologies.
So remind me. But if you have followed the series, the Cork's family certainly has played an increasingly important role in all of the stories. In fact, usually each book will focus on one member of the family along with Cork. I'll highlight somebody. Desolation Mountain, that was Cork and Stephen.
Mm-hmm.
Cork will always be there. We're not sure about Henry, but Cork will always be there.
I don't know. Henry's 105. He's been doing pretty good so far.
Yeah, you know, I am just now starting the next in the Cork O'Connor series, and I have to be very careful how I handle that story. I'm not going to say anything more about it, but I will be careful in that regard.
Nope. Like, yep, they're all sitting around waiting to see if he shows up.
Yeah.
All right. So I don't know if I really had too much more on Fox Creek. I loved, like I said, I love the characters. I love what you did with, I'm not French. I'm going to try to say Le Loup. You pronounce the P in that? Le Loup?
Yeah, Le Loup.
Gotcha. One of those downsides of always, you know, reading books and not actually hearing things pronounced. I wasn't always sure I had Henry Malou if I was saying his name right either. But I love what you did with the character of LaLoupe. You know, it's definitely added a different side to that. I really appreciated that. And I've completely, I apologize. I've just, the sister's name has just jumped out of my head. The sister of the man that's missing. Why have I just lost it?
Of the man that's missing.
They're all looking for.
Oh.
I was about to turn around and grab the book.
Wait a minute. Oh, let's find out.
Why can I not remember the sister's name?
Belle. Are you talking about Belle?
Yes, thank you.
Oh, okay.
Belle, I, it shot out of my head and it would not come back.
Yeah, don't worry about it. For a moment, it was not in my head either.
But I love the kid. What's going on with that one? I don't feel like anything was forced, but it's obviously there. And like I said, I just
well, we're looking. I'll give you just a little bit of a peek behind the curtain for the next book. It's wedding time in Aurora for Stephen and Belle.
Oh, nice! So it's good to see that that's coming up.
Things don't go as planned.
Well, it wouldn't be a book if it didn't. I mean. Let's face it, nobody wants to read it happily ever after.
Yeah, exactly. But I will say this, Ed. I think one of the reasons people read mysteries is because typically at the end you wrap things up in a way that sets the world right again. So although people love to read about mayhem and threats and the world in disarray, in the end, I think one of the attractions of the mystery genre in general is that the world in the end typically is set right. Not in all of them. You know, you get the very dark end of the genre where that is not necessarily true. I don't write in the dark end of the genre.
No, I appreciate that. I have to say that most everything, is pretty well wrapped up at the end of Fox Creek. Obviously, you still have a few questions. For instance, like I had about Belle, you know, where is that going? That wasn't necessarily wrapped up. But you also have to leave a little unwrapping so people come back to the next book, which I appreciate. So, like I said, Fox Creek's already out, and I'm going to mention one thing to everybody here, because we're going about to talk about The Levy, which I'm basically going to let Kent talk about, because I have not gotten a hold of The Levy yet. It is audiobook only, but I did talk to the guys over at Libro.fm, and they, on November 23rd, I asked them about it, because the fact was coming out. First of all, I was trying to get a copy. That didn't happen. But what they did do is they put it on sale. I don't get a kickback. You don't need a code. All you have to do is you go over to Libro.fm right now, and it's normally $22.99. That's going to be the retail price. Libro.fm has it on sale for $13.99 through the end of January.
Rush out and buy that book now.
Exactly. I love the fact that they did that for us. One thing, the reason I want to talk about Libro FM, and this is just really, really short again, not sponsored, nothing. I just love the fact, if you're like me and you love the indie bookstores, Libro.fm is a place where every little purchase you get, you can pick your local bookstore. If you don't have one, use the Bookworm in Omaha. but if you don't have one, like I said, if you buy there, they give a little bit of piece of the action to your local independent bookstore, who obviously most of them aren't going to be carrying an audiobook. Not these days. It's not like the old days where you had a big old cassettes and DVD or CDs of everything. Most audiobooks are online now. So just wanted to point that out there. But getting to The Levy, like I said, all I know about it was the blurb, the talk about it. What do you want to tell people about it that might, you know, get them interested in this book that's coming out and getting it while it's still on the sale price?
Sure. This is a novella. Which is why we chose to bring it out as an audiobook original, an experiment. I've never done this before. And it is a novella that has been 50 years in the making. I first took a crack at writing this novella when I was in my 20s. Didn't do such a great job, but I always loved the idea of it. Took another crack at it when I was in my 30s. Thought I did a better job of it, Took one more crack at it and it got a little bit better. And then during the pandemic, when I wasn't out, I typically am out touring all the time. When I wasn't doing that, I wrote two Cork O'Connor manuscripts. I wrote four novellas. And this was one of the novellas that I decided I was going to go back and really shape the story as finely as I could. And I'm so happy with the way it turned out. Here at 72, I finally know how to tell that story.
Well, I mean, sometimes, it needs time to, just simmer. It's got to get to where it needs to be. And I'm going to say this right now. There's the one, if there's anything good about the pandemic, the one good thing about that I've seen is there's a lot of my favorite authors that A, have sat down and done a lot of writing, a lot of really good books. Because, I mean, you got nothing else to do. If you're trying to keep everybody else safe, you're spending time away from everybody. And again, people know that I started doing this because of the fact that I'm totally miss author events, miss talking to you guys. I mean, I've seen you a couple times in Omaha myself. I don't know if you remember, but I've got that one picture of you with a Brian Freeman book looking at it, like, what the heck is this? Which he appreciated, by that way. I sent that to him. You guys are like right on top of each other. You're in St. Paul and he's in Minneapolis, or do I have those reversed?
Yeah, you've got it right.
Okay, so yeah. I mean, so like you guys are a stone's throw away from each other, but I really, as a fan of books, I really miss that. I miss going out and see the authors, see you guys talk about what's going on. So, I mean, it has like this is something that I've had where I've been able to talk to you guys and hopefully bring other people in. I'm not seeing any questions today, so this is more of a chat than I would normally do, but that's okay. I think we've talked about a lot of stuff. So you didn't give me a whole lot of details on the levee, but maybe that's the way we want to keep
Oh,
it.
no. I can give you a little bit more about the
Okay.
levee. It's set in the spring of 1927 during what is the worst, I think it was 27, maybe it's 29, during the worst flood in American history. The Mississippi River spilled over its banks and spread out 80 miles. The river was 80 miles wide far down south in the area where the story is set. It's set in Tennessee, on the Tennessee side of the Mississippi. And it's the story of some convicts who are sent to try to rescue a family they believe are trapped by the flood. I was greatly influenced by a novella, a very long short story by William Faulkner called The Old Man, which is essentially the same setup where a convict is sent to help rescue a pregnant woman. And I love that story. And it inspired me about that same point in time when I read that story to think, well, maybe I could do something like that. So that's when I took my first crack at the levee.
If it's as good as the other stuff you've written, I'm all in. I'm waiting for that one to come in myself. Definitely going to be listening to that. I love reading, but I do like to throw in an actual audiobook once in a while to fall asleep too. So always appreciate that. I have noticed. I'm just going to ask you a question. If it's just the fact that you're a huge fan of history, obviously Cork O'Connor has always kind of been set in the present. But am I wrong to say that all of your standalones, other than that first one that you mentioned the other day, nobody's ever read, all of your standalone books, though, seem to be historical pieces?
Well, my fourth novel was my first standalone. It's a book called The Devil's Bed.
That's the one I was trying to remember.
It's a contemporary
It is.
novel. It's probably the most thriller-esque book that I've written. I wrote it kind of as an experiment. I wanted to see what it was like to write a book that was essentially a thriller, because most of the Cork O'Connor novels are pretty much mysteries.
Right.
But I wanted to give a shot to that. But aside from that, you've got Ordinary Grace and This Tender Land, both of which have an historical setting. And the standalone that's coming out next fall, a book called The River We Remember, also has an historical setting. It takes place in 1958. And I think I like working in the past with those books because I don't know, there's something to me sort of, I don't want to romanticize. But I can wrap my understanding around the past a lot better than around what's going on in the world today.
Well, I just think it's kind of funny to me because I almost feel like as for mystery writers, a lot of mystery writers like going the other way. They like to do the historical mystery books. But I think also that's because of the fact that when you're writing a historical mystery book, you don't have to worry about, it's like, well, you know, they wouldn't have had DNA, or I don't have to worry about security cameras. Right.
Exactly.
Writing a contemporary mystery is difficult. Yes.
It's easier in many ways in that respect, but you know, to believably create a particular period in time, historical period in time, you've got to do an enormous amount of research.
Oh, yeah.
To make sure that you can plop in the salient details that'll make it feel real to the reader.
Yeah, especially today. You can't get away with making a book without doing your homework anymore, because there are fact checkers all over the internet. They will call you out.
I get them commenting on my books all the time.
Oh my goodness. I can't even pick one out, but I know I've seen multiple times where like somebody will write a book and like they'll have something that happened in 1924, and then somebody jumps on and is like, that motorcycle or whatever wasn't made till 25. It's like, okay, dude, just chill. Did you enjoy the story or not? All right.
That's why those of us who are with major publishing houses have really fine copy editors. My copy editors have saved me so many times.
No, yeah, definitely. It's one of those things I think when you first start writing, you don't think about, and I'm not a writer, so I'm not saying this from experience, but you just have this feeling, okay, I'm going to write this book. And they'll like, and then you think, well, maybe I'll need somebody to edit. But I think most big authors like yourself, you've got, for instance, I know Brian, obviously everything goes through his wife first. I don't know if your wife pre-reads all of your books, but you've got a group of maybe what you call beta readers, and then you've got editors, and then you just have this team that kind of like, I wrote this great novel, and then they give it back to you with all like the little red marks and stuff. It's like, are you one of those, that brings me another question. Are you one of those authors that tends to edit as you go, or do you write it and then go back? Because I know every author does a little bit of their own editing as well, obviously.
Well, sure. You want to try to get it as fine as you can possibly get it before you put it into anyone else's hands. Generally speaking, that's my approach. So I try to, for 20 years or so, I was a part of a Reader's Critique group. All of us wanted to be mystery writers. We called ourselves, get this, Ed, we called ourselves creme de la crime. It was pretty cute. But we all wanted to be mystery writers, and we read and critiqued each other's work. So my first probably 12 or 13 novels in the Cork O'Connor series were all read and critiqued by this very knowledgeable group of people, a huge help. So when I was finished with the manuscript and their work with me and sent it to my agent, who is also, has always been a really fine editorial eye. Her editorial comments tended then to not be really broad or really deep, because they didn't have to be. And then when it goes to my editor, who is, I have some of the finest editorial people in the business that work on my novels. And then they don't have to look at all of the stupid mistakes that other people have caught, and they can look at more substantive issues. And I really appreciate that kind of level of critical eye. You know, you can't have a huge ego, I don't think, in this business, because every writer needs those good editorial eyes. You just don't see everything.
No. How many of us in our everyday lives have written an email? And then you go back and look at it, and you're like, what the heck did I just say? Nah.
Now, multiply that by 99,000 words, you know?
Oh, yeah. I just give a shout out to you guys. I mean, every once in a while, yeah, a mistake gets through. But the fact that you guys, especially like, for instance, Cork O'Connor, what is it, 19 in the series, or is it 19 total books that you've written now?
19 in the series.
19 in the series. I can't imagine just trying to keep straight A, all of the characters and their personalities, B, the timeline, because you know if there's anything out of like, wait, that didn't happen yet. Just having to keep that much in straight and listed in the order that it happened and not make any mistakes. You need those groups to come back and say like, oh, hey, that, and he's like, oh, I didn't even think of that.
I have made errors as a result of that. Fortunately, they haven't been significant to the story, but there are some details that readers point out to me. Wait a minute, in this book, you did this, but now you're saying this. And I'm going, yeah, you're right. What can I say?
I did get a shout out from Stan Lee once for catching a mistake in a Spider-Man comic book. And that's my claim to fame. I'm just throwing that out there. He's like, yep, I missed that. I'm like, okay. That's my editorial high point. I'm not an editor. Okay. So I don't know if there's anything else exciting going on. I think anybody else had any other questions for you specifically. Like I said, I did completely and thoroughly enjoy the Fox Creek to the point that I have started back over on the series and I'm rereading it. Just a shout out to everybody who is watching or anybody who's going to watch this later on YouTube. I will have all the links in the thing. Oh, that I'm going to bring to the final question. I forgot to ask you. Just want to thank everybody for watching it. If you liked it, go ahead and hit the like button. If you happen to be a Amazon Prime member, you get a free subscription. Feel free to hit that. I don't like to ask for people's money, but that one's free, so you can spend that on me. The one question I forgot to ask you, Kent, and I can't believe I forgot this because I ask every author, shout out to your favorite bookstore.
Once Upon a Crime in Minneapolis, Minnesota. It's a wonderful mystery bookstore, and most of us who are mystery writers here in the area launch our books at Once Upon a Crime.
All right. I will put a link to them in the YouTube video as well. I know Brian had also mentioned them specifically, so they will definitely get a link. Obviously, all of your physical books, if you don't have a local bookstore, I'm sure Once Upon a Crime, for a fact, you can order from them. And I think that is it. I just wanted to thank you for your time, Kent. We are taking a break here on my channel through the end of the holidays. Let everybody enjoy themselves. And we will come back next year with, I don't know yet. I've got a lot of people talking. Nobody's picked a date. All right. All right. Thank you very much, Kent. Thank you for your time.
It's been a pleasure, Ed. Thank you.